Thank you very much, Sir Badamati. Very generous of you. Thank you. Yes, so welcome from me. Very, very good to see you all here. And welcome if you're sitting next door. Even though I can't see you, hopefully you can see me. Maybe you could give us a shout if you can see me and hear me. Good. That's very good to hear. And also welcome to you, if you're watching at home. I'm hoping that this is being broadcast live on Facebook. Todd gives me the thumbs up. So yes, welcome if you're watching at home. So as Sir Badamati was saying, we're looking at the Sangravastus, and we have done for, well, this is the third year. We looked last year at kindly speech, or Priyavadita, and how important speech is in our practice and in creating this culture that Sir Badramati was referring to. And the year before that, we looked at dana, or generosity, the sort of foundation for this culture of harmony, of sangha, really. And then today, this evening, I want to look at the third of these Sangravastus, which is artacharya, or beneficial activity. It could also, I guess, be translated as meaningful activity, meaningful or beneficial activity, artacharya. And I guess the larger sort of more mythic context is that these activities of generosity, of kindly speech, and of meaningful activity or beneficial activity are the activity of a bodhisattva. At its at their highest, they're what an enlightened being does. That's how they express their enlightenment in this conditioned world. And in doing so, they create sangha. They create a culture around them where people can hear the Dharma and flourish. So, of course, that's at its highest. And, of course, that's the sort of culture that we're aspiring to. But in a sense, I don't think we can leave it to the bodhisattvas to create that culture. We have to create that culture. In a way, we have to aspire collectively to be the bodhisattva, to create the culture that we would want to see and live in and practice in for ourselves and for others and for those, hopefully, generations to come that will benefit from what we've done. And of course, we, of course, are beneficiaries already. This year, in 2018, it's the 40th anniversary of the founding of the London Buddhist Centre, of the opening of the London Buddhist Centre. It was November 1978 that this centre opened. I wasn't here. Though I may look old, I wasn't that old. I wasn't here. And so for me, it's stories that I hear about people who founded this centre, who built this centre. One person who was here is Padmavajra, who's sitting in the room. And Padmavajra was one of the people who helped create what we, what I and what all of us here are benefiting from. It was beneficial activity, I think, par excellence. I feel very, very grateful for what I've received. It's been transformative for my life. And it's because of that that I want to play a part in, well, continuing and building on that. It's a privilege to do that. So, more broadly, beneficial activity, artacharya, you could say it's activity that is helping to create a better world. It's helping to create the world that we want to aspire to live in for, as I say, for ourselves and for generations to come. A world that, as it were, favours individual growth and the flourishing of human potential. That's the sort of world that we're trying to create. That the sort of a world where, yes, everybody is valued for their uniqueness, but also for the potential that all human beings share, which is the potential for enlightenment, for complete transformation and liberation. it's a world which would encourage that and support that development. And of course, the larger world doesn't always do that. At its best in the larger world, we do meet kindness, we meet support and encouragement for the flourishing of our lives. But very often, and for many, many millions of people, they don't have that. They don't have that at all. In fact, many, many millions of people right now are living in hellish states, materially hellish states, war zones, psychologically hellish states. So that's also part of the world that we live in. And I guess what Bhante Sangharakshita's vision was in founding this movement and this order was to create a, even if it was a small beacon of light for that suffering world, to create, he called it the nucleus of a new society, a nucleus around which a new society could form, where people were encouraged to flourish in their unique way and also in this way that is common, universal to us all, to human consciousness, this potential for enlightenment. And in a way, all of us have entered into that enormous, ambitious project. Just by being here tonight, we are part of this project that Bhante Sangharakshita conceived of. Conceived of isn't the right word. He says that it wasn't him who founded the order and movement. He says that it was as if it was some sort of energy, force, whatever you want to say. And he's speaking poetically, but also truly. He's saying that it was as if some sort of energy was founded through him. And Bhante had several teachers when he was living as a monk in India, in Kalimpong. One of those teachers, who became not just a teacher but a close friend, was a Tibetan Rinpoche called Dada Rinpoche. And Bhante says that Dada Rinpoche was, he's no longer alive, but when he was alive, he said he was a living bodhisattva. And it was Dada Rinpoche that gave Bhante Sangharakshita the bodhisattva vows. So Bhante, from Dada Rinpoche, committed himself to dedicating the rest of his life to bodhisattva activity. And this order and movement that results in this tonight is an expression of those bodhisattva vows. We are something of that outcome. So from a dharmic perspective, the highest gift that we can give somebody is the gift of the Dharma. Of course, it's not the only gift. And when we talk about beneficial activity, actually anything that helps alleviate suffering in the world, to whatever degree, is Artacharya. And of course, Buddhists don't have a monopoly on kindness. I was reading today about just a small kind of incident of a young man, a 19-year-old young man in the States somewhere, it didn't say where, and he was in a store called apparently the Goodwill store, buying coats, and he was buying lots of coats. So when he got to the queue for the checkout, he got, well, another man in the line asked him why he needed all those coats, what was he doing, and he was buying them for homeless people just on the streets. And the man who heard this was so moved that he took a photo of it and then posted it online, and it went viral. The young man who was buying the coats, I think his name was Patrick White, had no idea that it was viral. It was going viral. And when he was interviewed, he said, "Well, you know, when I was young," and he was only 19 then, we didn't have very much money, and we, you know, had to make do with whatever clothes we were given, and a coat had to last you a long time, and he just wanted to help others from his own experience of having gone without. It's just lovely, you know. And of course there are acts of kindness like that all over the world, all the time. I'm sure that we've been both recipients and agents for kindness in that way. And the Dharma doesn't have a monopoly on that. I do think, though, that as Buddhists, we should be exemplars, or trying to be exemplars, of kindness. I sometimes it's very lovely to be introduced by Subhadramati, but I don't always feel I am positive as those who live with me and know me. Well, I don't know, in the mornings, for example. would know. And when I think about talking about Artacharya, I am sort of painfully, humiliatingly reminded of how I don't always act from that exemplary, kindly way. Probably out of laziness and forgetfulness and self-preoccupation rather than badness, in a certain sense. But nevertheless, it's sort of sobering to stand up here and then be rejoiced in and then be encouraging all of us to be kind. But as Buddhists, Artacharya, yes, it sort of is kindness in action in all its forms, but particularly, most particularly, as Buddhists, what we can do is offer the Dharma. We can offer this path of meaning and fulfillment and liberation, which in a way not that many people in the world can offer. There aren't that many people in the world that can offer that. And actually, you don't have to be practicing, have been practicing for very long, to be an inspiration to somebody else. Something that you could, well, I made it a practice when I started coming along to the London Buddhist Centre. I made it a practice of, I didn't want to sort of be preachy, but if somebody asked me what I was doing, I wouldn't hide it. I'd say, no, I'm going to a meditation class or I'm going on retreat. Half conscious that that might speak to somebody. And these days, I've got a Buddhist name, Jnanavacha. So when somebody asks me my name, I tell them that it's Jnanavacha, and I'm half conscious that they might ask me what that means. Both yesterday and the day before, a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, is suffering from Alzheimer's, and the police contacted me because they were worried about him both days in a row. And both days in a row, the British Transport Police asked me my name and my ID and all the rest of it, and I said Jnanavacha. And yesterday the man said, so what does it mean to be ordained? And what do you have to do, and what do you do as a Buddhist? And he seemed to be genuinely concerned, genuinely interested. And we started a conversation, and he told me that his father had died just a year ago, less than a year ago, and he'd had dementia, and he felt very concerned for my friend, and there was such a lot of kindness in his response. I was very, very moved by the whole situation, but particularly the sensitivity and the kindness with which he handled the situation. But anyway, that was a bit of an aside. What I was trying to say is that we are in a position for each other, but particularly people who haven't yet come across the Dharma, to be tiny, tiny beacons of light. I believe that practicing the Dharma is in potential the most, not just in a way, it feels too small to say it's the most meaningful thing that one can do with one's life. Of course, you don't have to agree with me, but I believe that is what human consciousness, it's the fulfillment of what human consciousness is about. It's the fulfillment of what life is about. This quest towards enlightenment is, in a way, what all human beings are searching for. They may not call themselves Buddhist, but all human beings want to grow. And growth beyond a certain point means growth in consciousness. Every human being wants to be fulfilled, and enlightenment is that complete fulfillment. So in that sense, it's what life is orienting to, or ought to be orienting to. Of course, it gets obstacles dead in the way, don't they? Both internally and externally. So I think rather than Artacharya, I want in this talk to talk primarily about metta, about kindness. Because if we are going to be offering the Dharma to whatever degree we can, if we're going to try and be exemplars, we need to be practicing the Dharma. And that means we need to be working on our own minds in order to be of any real use to anybody else. Without working on our own minds, or to the extent that our minds are still clouded with self-centeredness, to that extent, our beneficial activity is restricted. It will be restricted. Or the converse is, to the extent that we can be free from our self-centeredness, we will be able to be more of a force for good in the world. And metta, of course, when it meets suffering, if we're in touch with metta, when it meets suffering, our natural response will be to try and help. To try and alleviate that suffering, do what we can. It'll be a natural response, not a thought through, I wonder what this will look like on the internet kind of response. It'll just be a natural response, as I believe it was for that 19-year-old. Shantideva, who was an 8th century Indian Buddhist, who is considered to be a bodhisattva, and it's his words that we recite in our Sevenfold Puja, in the Bodhicaryavatara, he says, "I would be a protector for those without protection." He's talking about how he would help in any way that was needed. "I would be a protector for those without protection, a guide for those who wander, a boat, a bridge, a causeway for those who long for the other shore. For all beings, I would be a lamp for those needing a lamp, a bed for those needing a bed, a slave for those desiring a slave." So they are the words of a bodhisattva, expressing this urge to just help wherever help is needed, in whatever way it is needed. And in a way, Shantideva's not making a distinction there between being a bed, a lamp, but also he is saying he aspires to be a bridge, a boat, a causeway for those longing for the other shore. And of course, that can mean the shore of the other shore can mean nirvana. But yes, we have to be working on our own minds, which all of us here, I know, will have been doing. However long you've been coming along, even if it's just your first few weeks here, you'll have learned to meditate and you'll be working on your own minds. You'll have started to learn about the ethical precepts, and that is another way of working on our own minds. Of course, when we say working on our own minds, that's so that we can act from metta. It's not enough just to be cultivating metta in our meditations. In fact, unless that metta is active, unless it becomes a responsiveness to other people in our lives, well, even our meditation can just become a sort of refined selfishness. So meditation isn't an end. It can't be an end in itself. But what I want to say is that metta, in a sense, isn't enough. In a sense, when it's relatively pure, it's not enough. Because metta as we know it, will, this side of enlightenment, it's still going to be clouded by our deluded minds. It will still be, to some degree or other, operating in this dualistic framework that the unenlightened mind can't help but inhabit. And that dualistic framework sees me as separate to you, and you as separate to each other. This idea that we are separate entities, which at a physical level we are, obviously we're separate in some ways, but the enlightened mind sees through the superficial separateness to some very true and deeper and more mysterious connectedness that connects us in a way that in a way I'm not going to be able to describe. But consciousness isn't separate in the way that our bodies appear to be. Even our bodies, actually, if you think about it, they're not separate. We're breathing the same air all the time. How could we really be separate from each other? But certainly at the level of consciousness, we're not separate. But the unenlightened mind can't help but fall into this trap of separation, of dualism, of seeing that I am somehow apart from the rest of the world, from others, from all beings. So my metta is in a way still based on that delusion. Even when I am able to be kind, I still have a sense of, oh yes, I am being kind to somebody. And my metta bhavana practice, there's still very often a sense of me as a different being to the other. At times, though, you can start to transcend that in the metta bhavana. I don't know if you're familiar with this experience, but in the fifth stage of the metta bhavana, particularly, although it can happen in any stage, you can just start to feel that you're not generating metta, you're not cultivating metta, there is just metta flowing, and it's for you and for all beings. It's just flowing, it's just like sunlight flowing down onto the world, and you can't say it's yours or anybody's. It's not a possession that you can own. That gives you a bit of a glimpse of what a bodhisattva's or a Buddha's metta might look like or feel like. It's probably a pale reflection of a reflection of what a Buddha's love metta would look like. But it gives us a bit of a sense that there are other ways of perceiving, other ways of being than our normal habitual preoccupation with me as being separate from the rest of the world. So why ordinary metta isn't enough is because metta on its own may not, probably won't, unless it's coupled with reflection of the sort that I'm talking about, lead to full and perfect enlightenment. There will have to be some understanding and reflection on how this instinct of separateness is deluded. We will have to look at that in our own experience. Or in other words, we'll have to cultivate wisdom. We'll have to cultivate prajna, or wisdom for metta to really take off in the way that it does in a Buddha. Context, I think, is really important. The reason I'm saying this is because I think that context helps define meaning. What I mean by that, well, in a way you can understand that just in ordinary terms, like words only acquire meaning within a sentence, which only acquires meaning within a paragraph, which only acquires meaning within a larger context. Context without context, the word doesn't really have a place, really. Well, similarly, this word kindness or metta requires context. Artacharya as a beneficial activity requires contextualizing for its full meaning to unfold. And its context in its fullness is a bodhisattva or bodhisattva activity to create this culture of sangha. That's really important because kindness, as I said, isn't just a monopoly of Buddhism. Many, many people are kind. I dare say many, many people are much kinder than I am, even though I'm a practicing Buddhist, and they may not be. Kindness is thankfully not just restricted to practicing Buddhists, thankfully, fortunately. But Artacharya in its fullness is more than just that. Its context is to create, we're trying to create a culture where human beings can reach enlightenment, can be supported to reach enlightenment. For that to happen, we have to not only be striving towards enlightenment ourselves, but ideally have some sort of glimpse, perhaps a glimpse of a glimpse, of what that goal looks like. The more that we have that ourselves, the more we'll be able to help others orientate towards that. Otherwise, you could say that, metta, kindness, beneficial activity, you could contextualize it in a secular context, couldn't you? You could say you could be a secular humanist and a thoroughly good person. But the goal wouldn't be the same. The goal wouldn't be the same. So prajna, or wisdom, is in this context, it's something that the Buddha was particularly clear about. Now, I don't know, there might be people who have never heard of Buddhism who have glimpses of vision. In fact, I'm sure there are, because, again, wisdom isn't a prerogative just of Buddhists. But the Buddha showed a path to wisdom that is extremely clear and very, very precise. Well, he showed many, many ways to wisdom. He showed that we do need to purify our hearts and minds in order to realize the truth. That a mind that is mired in self-centeredness, the more self-centered we are, the less we're going to be able to see the truth. You know, in conventional Western society, when we think of something like a subject, we think we should be able to understand it if we persevere intellectually with you know, like maths. Well, actually, not everybody will be able to understand maths. But you know what I mean? We think that if we only have the right conditions, we'll be able to understand it. But with wisdom, you have to have the right heart. You have to have the right mind. It's not a subject like any other subject. And the more trapped by our own self-centeredness, our self-clinging we are, the less we're likely to be able to see the truth. the less likely we'll be able to see that. So, of course, the Buddha taught the threefold path of sila, samadhi, prajna, of ethics, meditation, and wisdom, a progressive path in purifying our actions in sila and our minds more deeply through samadhi. And then we start to cultivate wisdom. When I came along here, I was 27, and I wasn't interested in sila or samadhi or beneficial activity or kindness. None of what I'm talking about would have particularly held my attention for very long, embarrassingly enough. I was, however, interested in the truth. I did believe that there was more to life and that somehow we weren't perceiving reality as it is. I was convinced of that. I was convinced of that partly because I was convinced that death wasn't the end. When my father died, I had an intuition and then even some experiences which convinced me that death wasn't the end. And then I was just gripped. If death wasn't the end, what did that mean life was? And I knew that we weren't seeing it as it really was. So that's what I was interested in. I was interested in prajna, in wisdom, in enlightenment, in the truth. And I came along here, and I was very, very timid, actually. I was scared of walking through the red door. I walked past several times, thinking, I don't know if I can go in. I didn't really feel worthy of entering this place. I was also scared of being disappointed because for a number of years I'd decided that Buddhism was the answer, even though I didn't know why. Anyway, I did ring the bell, and they let me in. And I signed up for a Buddhism course shortly after. And the Buddhism course, there were two order members, they were leading the course. I was very, very excited. These were, as far as I was concerned, beings who were either enlightened or very, very close. I mean, they might have been, but I'm now, being an order member myself, I know that not all order members will be. I certainly am not. But at that time, I just thought, my goodness, these people, they're the real thing. I'm going to learn over this 6-week course. I paid my money. I'm going to learn about enlightenment. And that very first week, they said, oh, yes, what this course is going to be about is the five precepts. We're just going to focus on ethics for this 6 weeks. And I thought, no. no, you don't. One of them started talking about acts of kindness, random acts of kindness, like offering biscuits to people who were hungry, a bit like I've been doing now. And I thought, no, don't be silly. There's more to life than kindness. Over the 6 weeks, unfortunately, I kept coming. And what I was struck by, I can remember in a way the moment quite clearly, is that I was struck by their kindness. I was struck by how kind they were in responding to different people in the group, including myself. I can remember asking a question which I was a bit timid and, you know, it was probably a silly question. I don't know what the question was anymore. What I do remember is this response which completely took me seriously. The order member concerned, Kevala, looked at me and he took me completely seriously. And I was really struck by his kindness. Sasana Jyoti was the other order member, and he was so patient with people, even though I could see that sometimes people weren't getting it. So I think I did learn something about the goal then. In fact, I think I learned something about wisdom, although I wasn't aware at the time that that's what I was learning. In a sense, it doesn't matter what brought you here. It might be that, like me, you were attracted to enlightenment, or it might be that you were in some sort of pain, and meditation, Buddhism offered, you felt, some sort of answer to suffering. Or it might be that you are looking for ways of benefiting the world. The world around us can feel a terrible, terrible place. Turkey has just intervened in the war in Syria in a not a very helpful way by attacking the Kurdish community in Syria. It's a terrible situation, made even more complicated and worse. And I know that sometimes people come to the Dharma because they want to make a difference. They want to try and make a difference in what can feel like a hopeless situation. What I'm saying is that all of those reasons are good. Any reason, actually, that brings you here is good. But ultimately, we will have to, if we're going to pursue the Dharma or try to pursue the Dharma to the end, then we're going to have to look at developing a less selfish heart, a heart that's freer of self-clinging, and we're going to have to look at developing wisdom. And the root delusion that we're all unenlightened ones, all of us unenlightened ones are labouring under, is that there's a real me separate from a real world out there. That there's a real me and there's a real world, and the two are separate. And all of that's wrong. The real me bit, the Buddha said it can't really be found when you try and look for the essential essence that I call myself me. It can't be found. The real world bit, that seems such a common sense assumption, when you look more closely, it doesn't seem to exist independent of our consciousness, of our interpretation. There isn't an objective reality out there that we've suddenly stepped into. And then this real me being separate from the so-called real world, separation, doesn't really make any sense. Even the fact that we're breathing means there can't be really separation from me and world. So that's what we're aiming to undermine. That's what we're going to be trying to undermine, at least from a particular perspective. But then I want to say prajna is not enough, wisdom is not enough. It can start to sound like that is the whole goal of the Dharma life, that we see through this constructed delusion, we realise that separation, we realise not just intellectually, but in our own experience, in our sort of very bones, we realise that separation is a delusion. We realise even that it's even our notions of space and time are mind-made constructs that don't exist independent of experience. We realise that this sense of me being separate from others is a very, very superficial veneer that doesn't reveal the truth of what it is to be alive. All of that can, it's a lofty enough goal to realise that. But here, at least, I want to say that that's not enough. Perhaps if prajna was in its fullness, certainly the Buddha did teach Sila Samadhi Prajna as the threefold path. In its fullness, maybe it would be enough. But it's possible, I think it's possible, to have sort of partial seeing, partial realizations, partial glimpses of this truth. Perhaps you've all had some sort of glimpse of the truth of what the Buddha taught. It's possible to have a sort of partial experience of what enlightenment is, and yet not be fully transformed. In fact, it's unlikely that we will be instantly fully transformed. The path doesn't end with our first glimpse of vision. In a way, that's where the path sort of really, that's where the path begins, when we see for ourselves that the Buddha was teaching the way things are. He was teaching the truth. When we see that for ourselves, that's when, in a way, the work begins, the real work begins, and it's the work of transformation. So then every aspect of our self-centeredness has to be transformed in the light of that vision. So that's why I'm saying that, in a sense, prajna isn't enough. Prajna in its fullness would be enough, but those glimpses are just the beginning. The danger is that if we mistake a partial seeing, a partial vision, for the whole thing, and we aren't yet fully transformed, there's still egotism and self-centeredness and self-clinging still within our experience. The danger is that we can appropriate the real glimpses of vision that we have had, and we can start to think of ourselves as, well, perhaps as special, perhaps as having done it. Perhaps we think that we've reached the end of the path, that we've come to the end. And if we do that, we'll have created another obstacle, and it'll be a difficult obstacle to overcome. It's much harder to see subtle self-clinging than it is more gross selfishness. The gross selfishness of me. This evening we were having supper, and a guest, who are you? Oh, there you are, Adam, had brought some chocolates, some Buja Bujas, into the community, for supper. And we had several guests this evening. We were all sitting around the table. Maitra Bandhu had cooked. And I was sitting opposite Adam, who had put these Buja Bujas on the table. And my hand, I was still having my meal. My hand was on the Buja Bujas. It was just there, on the chocolate. Sort of guarding it, I guess, against other hands, against my brothers in the Dharma, who you know, had cooked me this delicious meal. And Adam just said, "Oh, your hand's on the chocolate." and I had to concede that yes, it was. There it was. And it's not very subtle, that sort of self-clinging. It's there for all to see. That self-clinging was very, very evident. But sometimes, as we practice the Dharma, our selfishness gets more and more, as it were, refined, which is a good thing, but it's also harder to spot. It's harder to spot. We can start to behave in a way that does feel generally, it is generally kind. But there are traces of clinging still to be eradicated, and sometimes those subtler clingings are much harder to spot. Although letting go of the chocolate can be, you know, demanding in its own way. So, in that sense, prajna isn't enough, and I think I want to say that because those of us who have been practicing a long time, particularly if we've been ordained, Bhante's vision of the Dharma is that it's open-ended. The goal doesn't have a limit to it. It's not that you arrive somewhere and then you settle down. He does say, as the Buddha said, that it is possible to eradicate greed, hatred, and delusion, all traces of it. But then something else opens up, some other way of being. Consciousness opens up in an unlimited way, in unceasingly creative ways. The image that we have on the shrine, not everybody can see the image of Tara, but you've got this image of the Buddha, the Buddha Amitabha, and below him, if you can see, is this image of Tara. Both are images of this unceasing creativity. The Buddha didn't just sort of, his consciousness didn't just reach some sort of stasis, which was happy, free of suffering, but sort of had done it. There's unceasing creativity. And that's really, really important to remember, that the path, in a sense, doesn't have an end point. And it's that yes, Bhante has pointed to, the Buddha pointed to, but it's possible for us to misinterpret. It's still possible, even, well, particularly if you've been practicing a long time. The other reason that, in a way, prajna isn't enough is that the Buddha, well, he said to have reached enlightenment at the age of 35, and he spent the next 45 years of his life teaching, wandering around the roads of northern India ceaselessly, meeting as many people as he could, as many different people as he could, and trying to communicate what he had discovered. And thankfully he did that. Many, many people in his lifetime became enlightened, and then there's said to be an unbroken lineage, well, there is, of that teaching that we are the heirs to. That was the Buddha's compassion in action. That was enlightened compassion. The enlightened mind, which has transcended all limitations of consciousness, which is free from all pain apart from the physical pain of the body. The enlightened mind experiences no other suffering. That prajna manifests then in ceaseless compassionate activity. That's how it appears. That's how it presents itself. So in a sense, prajna isn't the end point. There's an outpouring, a spontaneous outpouring of metta, of maitri. When it's enlightened metta, it's maha maitri, the great love, the great metta, the great kindness, maha maitri, where there's no distinction left between self and other. There's no distinction of separation. That is, in a way, the culmination of the path. And there's no end to that. There's no end. Perhaps the end would come if there were no suffering beings. If there were no suffering beings, maybe the bodhisattvas would rest in their bliss of enlightenment. But as long as there are suffering beings, and the Buddha taught that samsara is endless, the bodhisattva's compassion will be required, will be needed. And it's in that context that beneficial activity acquires its true meaning. That's what Artacharya is pointing to. It's the bodhisattva realized in prajna, acting out of compassion. Perhaps another way of looking at this is, I just want to, in a way, try and talk in terms that aren't explicitly Buddhist. So perhaps another way of looking at this is that we need, all of us, Buddhist or not, we need ideals. For a meaningful life, we need ideals, values, that transcend ourselves. If the aim of our life is just concerned with ourselves, happiness for ourselves, fulfillment for ourselves, we will not live a truly meaningful and fulfilled life. For any real human fulfillment, we have to be orienting, it's just a fact, towards values that transcend ourselves. The reason it's a fact is because the nature of reality is pointing to our lack of separation, our non-separation. So if we are trying to live this life just for oneself, for ourselves, we're going against the nature of reality, and we won't find fulfillment, not lasting fulfillment. So our values in life, we have to find values that are universal, transcendent values that aren't based in what I can get for me in this lifetime. For our own fulfillment. It's not even some sort of martyrish kind of thing. For our own fulfillment in this life, we will need to orientate towards values that take us beyond ourselves. So if you take the values of truth and beauty and goodness, if you take those three universal values which philosophers, Western philosophers, have talked about, truth and beauty and goodness, they are, in a sense, transcendent values. They can't be reduced to human greed and, in a way, even human need. They can't be reduced to utilitarian terms. They transcend all utility. They also transcend the notion of me and mine. And the separateness of me from you. Truth and beauty and goodness transcend that. They point to something beyond our ordinary consciousness. And I think you need all three. We need all three. One needs all three for a meaningful life. This is another way of talking about the goal. That in Tara, the image of Tara, in the image of the Buddha, all three are completely united and fulfilled. If you have truth without beauty and goodness, if you pursue truth without the other two, without sort of beauty and love, you could say, if you pursue truth, I think you could end up, the danger is of ending up with a sort of arid, dry, narrow, rather dogmatic, cold consciousness. Lacking, I think, in wonder, in gratitude, in reverence, in empathy, certainly lacking in compassion. Truth without beauty and goodness doesn't feel like it doesn't actually feel like truth. And beauty without truth and goodness, beauty as a value on its own, well, you can imagine that just leads to a very refined selfishness, where a sort of aesthete would enjoy beauty for pure pleasure without any sense of others and of the suffering of others, or without any real sense that the beauty is pointing to something about the nature of reality. I think a pursuit of beauty can actually be ugly. People who are obsessed with beauty in a certain sense, you can imagine sort of narcissism or pretentiousness or hypocrisy even. In a way that becomes selfish and ugly. And of course, goodness without truth and beauty, you kind of think, oh, well, maybe that's one's all right, goodness without truth and beauty. But it doesn't work in the end. Goodness without truth and beauty, I think it can be sentimental. Even kindness can turn sentimental. Well, we've probably all experienced that. Somebody who wants to be kind but isn't really aware of us and what we need. They're just trying to be kind to an idea of us. It's lacking in awareness. And awareness, of course, is the seed of truth. So kindness can just be sentimental. It can also, I guess, lead to a sort of self-punishing sort of martyrdom, where we're kind to others without really, in a sort of grit-your-teeth way, while we're sort of resentful increasingly angry. that can sort of happen, can't they? Activism can lead to, we kind of have probably seen, maybe even know of people who are trying to make the world a better place, but are unfortunately trapped in hatred themselves. So maybe that's another way of thinking about the values that we're trying to orientate ourselves to live a fulfilled and meaningful life. And I think in the end, that's what, you know, regardless of all the Buddhist teachings in terms of their technicality of the Sangravastus, the third Sangravastu and Artacharya, regardless of that, I think what I want to sort of end with is our need to live a meaningful life, a fulfilled life. And what I'm arguing is that that can only happen if the values that you're orientating yourself by are bigger than yourself. And the culture around us doesn't, I mean, the wider culture out there won't necessarily orientate you to those values. It might do if you're fortunate. But if you're not fortunate, if you just, I don't know, if you're just used to watching popular news or films or whatever it is, many of the messages will tell you that happiness is to be found by just getting what you want, materially and in other ways. If we get what we want, we'll be fulfilled. And that's a lie. And it's such a damaging lie in our culture. It causes such suffering, let alone is a trap that leads people to not find true meaning and true happiness. It's such a lie that it's I think it's evil, actually. I think it's the cause of a great deal of suffering, at least in our Western culture, which is of course more and more worldwide. So I think to make the most of our lives, look at the values that you kind of know you hold, but look at how we're orientating our lives from them. I find it helpful, and I have done from a young age, because my father died when I was quite young, I find it quite helpful to every so often look at my life from the perspective of how will it be on my deathbed? What will I sort of be satisfied with or regretting on my deathbed were I to die now, tonight? Where would my regrets be? And nobody is going to regret not having the latest iPhone on when it comes to their deathbed. None of us will anywhere regret that, I hope. I think I can speak for us all there. You know, both my parents have died, and my dad on his deathbed did have regrets, and he regretted not being kind enough. It wasn't that he was completely unkind, but he regretted not being kind enough. He'd been harsh. He'd had a harsh temper. And that's what he was saying. He could hardly speak. He was having a heart attack. I can remember holding his hand, or him holding mine. I don't know which way round it was. I was 11. He was on his bed in agony and confessing to his lack of kindness. My mother died 6 years ago, and she'd lived a very different sort of life. She had increasingly become, I think, a more and more selfless, loving, radiant woman. There was something about my mother that everybody seemed to love. After her death, we had strangers knocking on the door saying, you know, I can remember opening the door, and it was a woman from the Abbey National Bank in the branch in Finchley that my mother used to have a building society account in, and she, that was her only connection with my mother, was through that building society account, and she came and expressed her condolences, but was genuinely distraught. In fact, she was in tears. My mother was that sort of person. On her deathbed, I wasn't there when she died. I was away on a solitary retreat, I'm sorry to say. But my sister was there, and my mother died sort of suddenly. It was painless, actually. She just sort of, she was fine, and then she was gone. But one of the last things she was talking about was asking my sister to thank the doctor who she'd really, really liked. She said he was like a grandson to her, and she was really touched by him, and to thank the nursing staff, because how good they're being to her. Her last expressions were, I believe, expressions of gratitude and kindness. Well, all of us, I'm sure, aspire to the latter, but it isn't sort of bought cheaply. It isn't bought cheaply. You have to, we have to, if we're going to die well, we have to be living well, and we have to be starting now. And none of us know when death will come, and there isn't time to lose. And we do waste, and I include myself, unfortunately, waste a great deal of time. And I know that I'll look back and think, I wish I'd made more of the opportunities I'd been given. I've been given so many opportunities, not least, I've been taught the Dharma. And sometimes I don't make the most of that. And yes, I find that something that helps me as a reminder, as a spur. I want to share it with you to help, well, hopefully, if it's helpful for you, to be a spur to you, to not waste the opportunities for a meaningful life. And a meaningful life can be found in many, many ways, but it will involve values that go beyond self-centeredness. Yeah? At its height, and in Buddhist terms, when we let go of this delusion of a fixed and separate self, it's said that there will be a force that comes through us. It's, I believe, the force that came through Bhante when he founded this order and movement. It's the Bodhisattva's experience. It's called the Bodhicitta. It's a force that propels the person to try and alleviate suffering wherever there is, but not just to alleviate suffering, but to alleviate the causes of suffering. And the causes of suffering are our unenlightened, deluded state. So it's a force that compels us to practice the Dharma and to help others practice the Dharma and to create a culture, to create a world where all beings can practice the Dharma so that they can be led to enlightenment, so that they can be led to a transcendence of all pain. And this bodhicitta, Shantideva talks about it as the this will to enlightenment, this force, is also what leads to our own fulfillment. So we now enter into a sort of paradoxical state where we can only be fulfilled through creating a world where others can be fulfilled, because the distinction of self and other has gone. And it's the bodhicitta, when it arises, that is said to really give meaning to human existence. So I'll finish with the words of Shantideva, and then we'll leave it there. So he says of this bodhicitta, he says, it's the supreme cure for the world's sickness. It is a tree of rest for the wearied world wandering on the road of being. for the caravan of famished beings blundering on the road of existence, it is a banquet of joy which refreshes completely all who hunger for happiness. Today I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all the happiness of the Dharma. May gods, titans, and all rejoice. Thank you.